Hello and welcome to A Health Podyssey. I'm your host, Alan Weil. The entire April 2024 issue of Health Affairs focuses on the topic of perinatal mental health and well-being. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with our two issue advisors who oversaw the process of defining the issue contents and shepherding the articles through to completion. Now, addressing perinatal mental health needs is a critical health system priority. One in five pregnant or postpartum people has a diagnosed mood or anxiety disorder, and left unaddressed, these disorders can have lasting negative effects on the person, their child, their family. So how can we design a health system that better addresses perinatal mental health needs? And how can we think about broader societal changes that would improve perinatal mental health outcomes? These are questions we'll discuss in today's episode of A Health Podyssey. I'm here with Karen Tabdina, professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Emily Dossett, associate clinical professor of psychiatry and obstetrics and gynecology at the Keck School of Medicine, University of Southern California. In addition to serving as issue advisors, Drs. Tabdina and Dossett and their co-authors published an introductory paper in the April 2024 issue of Health Affairs that commented on the perinatal mental health policy landscape. We'll dig into what they discussed and more in our episode today. Dr. Tabdina, Dr. Dossett, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Hello, and thank you for having us both.
I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to engage both of you in this important conversation. I assume that some of our readers have sort of vague familiarity with the topic of perinatal mental health, but maybe not a deep familiarity. So could we just set the stage? What do we know about the incidence and the health burden associated with poor perinatal mental health? And maybe the first time you speak, I'm going to ask you to say who you are, so that our audience starts to recognize your voice, and after a moment, they won't need that anymore.
I am Dr. Karen Tabdina, professor at the University of Illinois, and I've been conducting perinatal mental health equity work for nearly two decades.
So tell us what we need to know about the incidence and the health burden associated with poor perinatal mental health.
Perinatal mental health challenges are surprisingly common. As referenced in our special issue of one in five individuals experiencing some sort of challenge during the perinatal period, meaning pregnancy up to a year after giving birth, coming out of a post-COVID era, we learned that during COVID, one in four people, so 25% of people, experienced some sort of mental health challenge. While we were just starting to grapple with perinatal depression as a society, we were faced with other conditions such as perinatal anxiety, bipolar, and even psychosis that emerged at record numbers. We also know that perinatal mental health challenges, if untreated, represent risk for both mother and baby, impacting the full family system, and that perinatal mental health challenges are experienced unequally across our minoritized populations, being LGBTQ, racial and ethnic minority populations, and non-English speaking populations. So with that being said, I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Dossett.
Thank you. Yeah, so along with this high incidence of what we call perinatal mental health challenges, there's a big burden. You know, I'd like, first of all, to just kind of take a step back and say what we actually are talking about when we talk about perinatal mental health challenges. We're talking about both diagnosed disorders, such as depression, as well as the impacts of stress and lack of support that can lead people who are pregnant and postpartum to have a general sense of emotional discomfort, mental health struggles, and then the physical challenges that go along with that. Aside from depression, though, which is often what gets attention, we also have very high rates of anxiety. Anxiety in all its forms, including phobias, obsessive compulsive disorder, panic disorder, as well as more severe illnesses like bipolar disorder or even chronic mental illness. And all of this can be compounded by substance use disorders. When we say perinatal, we're talking about everything from conception or even preconception all the way up to 1 year postpartum. And I think this is an important point because officially the diagnosis of anything perinatal per the medical billing and coding and diagnosis system has to happen within the first 4 weeks after delivery. But in reality, we know that some of the worst outcomes, such as maternal suicide, happen much later than that. The other piece that I would like to point out is that the burden of really all of these illnesses can lead to not only the mental health challenges, but as I said a moment ago, physical challenges for a variety of reasons, including inability to engage in prenatal care, poor self-care, hormonal dysregulation, lack of support, and then in the postpartum, an increasing sense of isolation, loneliness, and symptoms that can lead to difficulties with bonding between parent and child. So there's obviously a lot to say on this topic, but I will leave it at that for now.
Well, I appreciate the introduction, and those who want to learn more know where to find it. I do think it's probably worth a moment noting that in the news and in the policy discussion these days, we hear a lot about maternal mortality. We hear about very high rates in the United States, very high disparities between the heavy burden for Black birthing mothers. These issues are related, but they're not the same. Can one of you help me sort of see what's similar about them and how we might also need to think about them differently?
Well, the backdrop to both of these crises is inequality, as we know as a nation, is something that we are well versed in the United States of America. Our maternal mortality crisis in this country is fueled by the rare events that we would see, such as sepsis and hemorrhage, but also a rising number of cases related to death, such as suicide and drug overdose. So many of our maternal mortality review committees in this country have split in two because the case numbers are so high that we now have maternal review committees for violent deaths. In these review committees, we are finding that untreated mental health problems are behind a lot of the cases that we're seeing. And these individuals are trying to engage with our healthcare system. They are presenting at our emergency departments. They are calling our helplines, and they are not receiving adequate care, even with our drug overdose cases that we see. And yes, I serve on my state's maternal mortality review committee, so I'm not identifying any deaths, but there are these patterns that we see across my own state and across the country where people are trying to receive mental health support. They might have thoughts of ending their lives or harming their child. They're sent home without resources, maybe a pamphlet if they're lucky, and they go home and they die by overdose in a way to self-medicate and cope with this situation that they are experiencing. And I mentioned untreated. There's also a notion of onset, where Dr. Dossett is our national expert on perinatal onset. Because for most people, they might experience a history of mental health challenges. They might know that they have this history, and we might know that there is a risk for reoccurrence. For some people, and it's not as rare as you would think, for some people, onset starts in the perinatal period, and that you're at higher risk for mental health challenges and to experience maternal mortality and morbidity.
I was just going to tag on to that with the onset piece. I think it's a valuable one. And I'm going to say something about suicide in just a moment as well. So about a third of people who experience perinatal mental health challenges actually had mental health issues prior to becoming pregnant. And the pregnancy is a life event that often can make those symptoms, quite frankly, worse for a variety of reasons. About a third of people have onset in pregnancy itself, and a third of people have onset after the baby is born. So that flies in the face of this common belief that all we have in this arena is postpartum depression, and that everyone just has symptoms after the baby's born. The other piece is just so relevant to our healthcare system and the cracks in it, quite frankly, is that most of the suicides and overdoses that happen, the maternal mortality drivers, if you will, happen between 7 weeks and 52 weeks postpartum. So what that means is that the birthing person, the woman, has usually had her last appointment with her OBGYN, which is at around 6 weeks. After that, she is on her own. And that is when the vast majority of suicides happen. And we know through studies in California from our own MMRC that the vast majority of these would have been preventable.
And depending on the state where that person gave birth, they may or might not be insured.
So that's a perfect segue into the next question I have, and maybe you've actually already answered it, but I'd like you to expand a bit. In the paper, you say the United States lacks an overarching healthcare system capable of meeting the mental health care needs of perinatal people and their families. I think you just gave me an example of that, but perhaps there's more that our listeners should understand about sort of the systemness or lack of systemness. You mentioned having the last visit and you're on your own. There are probably other places where people are on their own.
That's right. And, you know, I prefer to use the frame healthcare landscape because I think it's more accurate than the word system. We have a lot of small systems, but we don't really have one overarching perspective on how we need to be delivering this healthcare. So just a few examples. So one is what we just talked about. You know, women typically don't even go to the OBGYN until they are roughly 8 to 10 weeks pregnant. If you're lucky and have private insurance, you may get a preconception visit, but that's highly unlikely. After the baby is born, you have the 6-week visit, maybe more if you had a C-section or complications. But in general, that's around the time your care with your OB ends. You're expected to go to primary care at that point for further physical health treatment and some mental health treatment. But the reality is most young, otherwise healthy women often don't even have a primary care doctor. Their obstetrician is their primary care doctor. But you're going to the pediatrician all the time. You're going to the pediatrician 2 days, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, gosh, what, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 9 months after the baby's born. But the pediatrician is looking at the baby. You know, increasingly, we do have pediatricians who are aware of perinatal mental health disorders, but there's still no real policies that support screening and treatment for the mother, which is ironic because the mother's health is the most important factor in the baby's health. So that's within the health system. But then let's say that you go to your OB's office as expected, and you do have a mental health disorder. We're making inroads in this, but most OBs aren't trained to manage that. So they refer you to mental health. Well, mental health is usually an entirely separate system. And your insurance may very well carve out mental health services, which means you go to a provider that may or may not have communication with your physical health provider, because if they're in a different system, they're going to share different electronic medical records. So you might have an OB doing one thing, a therapist doing another, maybe a psychiatrist doing a third, and no one's communicating. So that's another way that there's fracture. And then a massive way that there's fracture and women falling through the cracks is the fact that we have entirely two different systems of healthcare based on how you're insured. You're either publicly insured or you're privately insured. And each has their own challenges. And I think that this issue that's going to be forthcoming actually spells out challenges in both systems really well. But payment drives so much of this, and women fall through the cracks as a result of non-cohesive approach to that payment.
I want to bring in another statement you make in the paper, and actually you alluded to it earlier. You say the burden of undiagnosed and untreated perinatal mental health challenges remains greatest among racially minoritized populations, such as Black, Asian, and multiracial people. Again, you've made reference to this, but I think it's really important that we take a closer look and not just understand the existence of that differential, but also what the implications are.
There are so many implications. In our nation, the way that the landscape operates, and to follow up on that analogy, is it operates under a perinatal mental health treatment pathway, which typically starts with a diagnosis. And in order to get to that diagnosis, clinicians start working out symptoms. So we look at symptomology. Do you have change in your sleep and your appetite and your ability to do things and your ability to express or feel joy? These symptoms add up to a level of risk, have probable depression to determine those who might be at risk for a clinical diagnosis. And once you have a diagnosis, then you can enter the pathway. As alluded to with private and public insurance, there are different paths to treatment and supports for mental health services based on one's ability to pay. I mentioned earlier that untreated depression carries the risk. It's untreated depression, anxiety, psychosis, bipolar disorder that present risk both in utero for baby and then on the postpartum side for mom in terms of substance use or for baby in terms of bonding and cognitive development or delays. What research shows us is that individuals who are minoritized, Black, Brown, Asian, multiracial, non-English speaking, such as Spanish speakers, are less likely to have a conversation with a provider, are less likely to receive that initial screen to assess for symptoms. And without those conversations or screens, they're less likely to receive a diagnosis of perinatal mood disorders, any sort of diagnosis for depression, anxiety, or bipolar, and be routed into care. This itself sets up a cascade of events where people are not able to get the help that they need and they are not able to manage their depressive episodes, and there is a series of events that take place. This is why in the paper we said that this burden is disproportionate for individuals from Black, Asian, and multiracial populations.
You all have done an incredible job of sort of laying out the challenge in front of us. The good news is your paper also gets into some recommendations for things we can do about this. You have 7 recommendations in the paper. We're not going to be able to review all of them, but I do want to talk through some of them. We'll do that after we take a short break. And we're back. I'm speaking with Drs. Tabdina and Dossett about the need for improvement in how we address perinatal mental health challenges. We've had a really robust conversation about the shortcomings of the landscape, not the system. I think that's something I'm going to keep with me because it certainly isn't a system, and that's part of the problem. But as I noted, your paper includes some recommendations, and we're not going to go through all of them. Our listeners should look at the paper if you want to see those. But I do think we should explore a few of them since we have time to do that. The first one has to do with broadening our understanding of perinatal mental health challenges. Now, given that you all have sort of defined what those are, tell us what you mean by broadening and what would that look like if we were to take a broader approach?
I'll define this a bit from the clinical perspective, and then I'm hoping that Karen can address it from the research perspective. At a very basic level, we need to broaden the language that we're using. You know, I mentioned a while ago that people say postpartum depression, and that's still what I hear all the time. But what that leaves out are all of the folks who suffer from symptoms and diagnoses outside of depression, like we've already talked about, as well as those who suffer not just in the postpartum period. So those who suffer in pregnancy and then months or even years after the baby is actually born. But over and over, you hear this phrase postpartum depression. So what does that mean? That means people don't get care because it means that they don't know that what they're suffering from is an actual thing. I've had women come into my practice who said, you know, I would have been here 6 months ago, but I have crippling anxiety. And I looked at postpartum depression online and that wasn't me. That didn't meet my symptoms. So I didn't come and get care. So it sounds like a small thing, but broadening language, whether it's in clinical practice, whether it's in public health campaigns, whether it's how we measure, right? Like right now we have new HEDIS measures, but they just ask for screening for depression in pregnancy and postpartum. And in my institution, we're also doing anxiety because that's what we see, is we see anxiety. So that's sort of the clinical piece of this. Along with it, we do need to actually broaden the formal diagnosis of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, even within medical kind of institutions like the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, because there is no postpartum anxiety. There is no postpartum psychosis. No, there's
not. I had no idea.
So if there's no actual diagnosis, that means you can't diagnose it. You can't train people to look for it. And furthermore, you can't bill for it. And if you can't bill for it, who's going to look for it, to be frank, since payment drives what we do? So that's a very basic piece in terms of broadening our understanding that advocates have been trying to get through for really decades now. But I do think that the time has come.
There's also need to broaden the definitions that we're using in our research studies nationally. We are only finding what we seek in the simplest terms. We have sought to understand onset of postpartum depression and how we can best treat postpartum depression. There have been a number of clinical trials and drug studies to address postpartum depression, but these studies are supporting postpartum depression and outcomes among higher income European American white women. And quite frankly, we have not started to discuss what the perinatal mental health landscape looks like for all Americans. Again, non-English speaking, Black, Asian, and multiracial individuals. In all of the studies where we have the data, we have TEMSIS, we have Medicaid data, we have large insurance claim data, we are seeing disparities in rates of diagnosis between Black individuals and Asian individuals. But we get into randomized control trials and smaller studies to test effectiveness of interventions. We are at best seeing the introduction of Black Americans at best and white Americans as the majority of these samples. So we need to do better on inclusion in our studies and the overall effectiveness of our studies and the reach of those studies, in addition to awareness campaigns and information. That is something that relates to our article on the perception of individuals from minoritized communities and how they think of perinatal mental disorders. But there's definitely a need for more education campaigns and awareness around the topic.
Now, both of you have already alluded to public and private coverage and how they can be tied to different delivery systems, different levels of coverage of care, different continuity and discontinuities in coverage. We talk a lot about payment policy at Health Affairs, and I wonder here, again, you do have a recommendation in the paper related to payment. If you could just say a little bit more about that as a lever for improving how we address these needs.
Sure. So I wish that our colleague, Twyla Dillion, who helped write the paper with us, was on this call. She's really the expert in this. But basically, just like definitions of mental illness and the type of research that we do, what type of healthcare is understood or determined is really how we pay for it, right? What we need to do is promote or create payment models that really more adequately support whole person care, right? So what do I mean by that? We are very, very good at this country at lab tests and procedures and medical treatments that are quantifiable, right? So if I'm pregnant and I have, you know, a horrible cardiac disease, or if I'm postpartum, you know, and I have sepsis, like, this country is where I want to be. And that is because those things are paid and paid very highly in the private insurance company. But the things that really provide a lot of evidence-based value for perinatal mental health disorders are those things which are not as quantifiable, right? They're not what a fee-for-service, a private plan, or a public plan that's fee-for-service is going to be able to, like, tick off in a medical chart and therefore provide a payment for, right? It's things like education. It's things like consultations and support for family. It's things like linkage to housing or food or domestic violence resources. Those are the things that actually really help perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, perinatal mental health challenges that often are not included in our traditional fee-for-service system. So what we need is a definition of capitated care or bundled care or whole person care that can be used to support providers who are actually enacting those kind of, if you will, soft services that really do make a difference. That's actually true in the public and the private system. There's a lot of movement towards this. I mean, I live in California. We're redoing our whole Medi-Cal system, which is what we call Medicaid, in order to promote this, but we still have a long way to go. And I'm going to hand it over to Karen. I do want to say that the last piece of this, it's vital, is that it's community-based organizations and not just traditional medical kind of institutions that are able to access this type of payment.
The only thing I wanted to add that's featured in our paper is these community-centered models of support to improve birthing outcomes, such as doula services and in-home home visiting, which have a focus on perinatal mental health and supporting the client, work. We've seen these outcomes on a number of small trials. We know that they work, but leveraging these types of supports to scale, to have them reimbursed, is an area that we see blockages. So Michigan is one of the states where Medicaid began to reimburse community health workers. These are low-cost, effective solutions to improve perinatal mental health. I can tell you I've learned a ton working in the Global South, where there's a different payment structure, and governments want better birth outcomes for the betterment of the country. And having home-based doula care and doula supports are something that are integrated in their payment structures. So there's a lot that we can learn on this topic from the Global South to improve our community healthcare systems.
I appreciate the focus on how payment affects what people get. It's striking as you read the paper, and I hope our listeners will. You have a number of recommendations that are outside of the realm of clinical care. You talk about income support, paid family leave, affordable child care. I can certainly get my head around why those would be important, but I'd really like to hear from you. If your goal is to improve perinatal mental health, why have these recommendations that go outside of the healthcare system?
So the primary reason is that it's evidence-based. And, you know, you said intuitively you could understand, and it makes sense. I would say in a nutshell, the primary way that some of these policies, and to name a few, they include things like paid family leave after a baby is born for longer than the traditional, you know, 2 to 6 weeks. They include income supports, right? Like the child tax credit, which thankfully is, fingers crossed, making its way through Congress as we speak. It includes things like affordable child care. The burden of child care, finding it and paying for it in this country is incredible. I actually have a very dear colleague who had to leave work last fall because she just straight up couldn't find child care for her little one. So what we know is that these family-supportive workplace policies actually improve mental health. So how do they do this? By reducing stress, right? If you're a new mom and you are still recovering physically and you're trying to establish breastfeeding and you're told you have to go back to work, how on earth are you going to manage that and everything that goes with it? Especially if you can't find childcare or childcare that doesn't take 30 to 40% of your income. So we need to have more accessible childcare that's heavily subsidized, and we need to pay childcare workers more so that we can increase that supply. As for child tax credit, when families are allowed to keep more of their money, they can do things like pay for housing and pay for food. I mean, it sounds so simplistic, but it's true. And there's some really good studies that show that a lot of the improvement in depression and anxiety when child tax credit was instituted was because they could pay for food and housing. I mean, what is more stressful to a new parent than not being able to put a roof over their child's head? I mean, I can give them all the antidepressants in the world, but it's not going to make a difference. So that's where these workforce policies, these tax policies, these paid family leave policies can really make a difference with perinatal mental health.
So as we come to a close, I would like both of you to reflect on your role as theme issue advisors. Whenever we do a theme issue, we know that many of our readers are expert in the field, and this is going to deepen their knowledge. But there are also people who are probably coming maybe for the first or second time to the issue, don't have the same depth. And we always want to make sure that those readers as well will come away with some ideas or ways of thinking about the topic that they didn't have before they picked up the issue. So I'm going to ask you both as we close, if you could just say what you hope readers of the issue will come away with as we finish up our conversation. And Dr. Tabdina, let's go to you.
After this April 2024 special issue, I wish that all readers and viewers that watch the YouTube channel are able to see that solutions are in reach, that there is so much positivity in the information that we are gathering. Information itself can be scary. As someone who's researched maternal death and maternal mental health problems and worked to share that information broadly, it also creates a lot of fear into the unknown, especially for people who are thinking about conceiving. For Black women such as myself who say, I want to get pregnant, but am I going to get discriminated when I give birth? What if I have a perinatal mental health problem? Is anyone going to catch it because of this information that we're putting out there? This special issue identifies many solutions. I absolutely appreciate the concept of reciprocity in home visiting that comes up as an introduction for tribal communities. I appreciate the notions of addressing trauma in pregnancy and in birth before going into the pregnancy. The Narratives Matter selection can produce hope for those who are thinking of getting pregnant or working with pregnant people. Okay, so don't be down on the information, the statistics that are presented from this collective work. There's one more thing I want to say about that. As a nation, we are experiencing this crisis that demographers call TFR. So it's our total fertility rate, and our total fertility rate is declining. I know that there's a generation right now that doesn't want the stress of a baby, that doesn't want to be sick in their head after having a pregnancy. I watch TikTok, I watch YouTube, I watch the reels, and I hear Generation Z saying that childbirth is not for them because of all of these problems that we've uncovered. So for those of you who are worried about our total fertility rate going down, or on the other side, that you are worried about experiencing childbirth yourself and experiencing those challenges, Let me tell you, there are issues identified in the special issue that are going to make sense to those people who are in charge of making policy, who are in charge of helping pay for services, and to better off improve outcomes in our country. So don't be afraid. Have that baby, experience that joy. Tell those around you, have that baby, experience that joy. Because it's not as scary as we're making it out to be. There are some triggers in the system that we've identified. We collectively are going to work on them and make things better so we as a nation can prosper and have healthy babies and happy mamas. So thanks for reading and watching.
Yeah, I love that. I love the happy babies and healthy mamas. And you have to have happy mamas to have healthy babies. So I think for me, I'll be very kind of short about this. One phrase I think of a lot is that a budget is a moral document. And policies are often, if not usually, around budgets and how we allocate our resources. And like Karen just said, we actually know what to do. I mean, this is not a problem that we don't have any solutions to, but we need to prioritize the health and the mental health of our mothers, our birthing people, our families, our children. And we need to do that by allocating the resources to make it happen, to apply these solutions. And we need to do that in a way that shows who we really value in this country. I think right now we're showing who we value, but maybe we need to rethink that a little bit. A budget is a moral document, especially when it comes to perinatal mental health.
Well, I'm really glad I asked that last question. I have to say I've recorded more than 100 episodes and no one has ever said, have that baby. So we'll get that. We've got that one on tape. But I appreciate both the moral call to action and the practical notion that there are solutions, that these are not intractable problems. We just have to take them seriously. Dr. Tabdina and Dr. Dossett, thank you for all the leadership you provided for this theme issue, for the paper that leads off the issue and walking through it with me. Thank you today for being my guest on A Health Podyssey.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you'll tell a friend about A Health